are here again, thanks to an economic boom generated by, of all things, bad times. Tens of millions of Americans have been knocked down and held down in recent years by the collapse of jobs and wages. This calamity has led to a second blow for millions of the same families, who now find themselves buried in overdue bills for credit card charges, student loans, and other consumer debt. But there's a bright silver lining in that dark financial cloud. Only, it's not for the indebted families, but for a booming breed of finance hucksters known as consumer debt buyers. Believe it or not, in the warped world of high finance, there's gold in them thar hills of bad debt. Such miners of human misery as Encore Capital Group buy bales of unpaid bills from banks and other lenders, paying pennies on the dollar. Then, they unleash packs of their hard-nosed, aggressive collectors on the families. If they still can't extract payment, the debt profiteers turn to their meanest dog, the courts. Debt firms routinely file thousands of lawsuits a day against financially devastated Americans. They know that most debtors can't understand the legal gibberish in the suits, can't afford a lawyer, and can't mount an effective defense against the corporate lawyers. So, some 95% of these lawsuits produce default judgments against hapless borrowers, meaning debt buyers can then confiscate the wages of borrowers or freeze their bank accounts. This is Jim Hightower saying, this boom in vulture capitalism is disgusting. But worse, it's subsidized by us taxpayers. We pay for that judicial system, the judges, courtrooms, and endless rounds of hearings. Predatory debt corporations have perverted our so-called justice system into their own subsidiary for squeezing profits out of destitute debtors.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
By combining claims of fetal rights with the war on drugs, new laws that punish pregnant women and families are being put into place around the country. There's a consensus in the medical community that addiction is a public health issue and that treating drug use in pregnancy as a crime undermines the health of both women and children. Yet, fetal rights advocates have convinced police, prosecutors, and judges to treat addiction as a form of abuse or neglect without regard for parenting ability. According to a recent report by the Guttmacher Institute, one state allows assault charges to be filed against a pregnant woman who uses certain substances. 18 states consider substance abuse during pregnancy to be child abuse under civil child welfare statutes, and 3 consider it grounds for civil commitment. 18 states require healthcare professionals to report suspected prenatal drug abuse, and 4 states require them to test for prenatal drug exposure if they suspect use. On the other hand, 19 states have either created or funded drug treatment programs specifically targeted to pregnant women, and 12 provide pregnant women with priority access to state-funded drug treatment programs. And 4 states prohibit publicly funded drug treatment programs from discriminating against pregnant women. These issues were among the concerns being discussed at last month's International Drug Policy Reform Conference in Washington, D.C.
I am Lynn Paltrow, and I'm the founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women.
Lynn, I first became familiar with your work about 13, 15 years ago. I remember the case Crystal Ferguson out of South Carolina. I want you to tell my listeners about National Advocates for Pregnant Women, and I wonder if you could start with Crystal Ferguson.
Sure. Crystal Ferguson is a woman from South Carolina. who went to the hospital when she was pregnant. She went to the Medical University of South Carolina, which is the patient base at that university is 70% African American. And she didn't know that at the time there was a white nurse who thought she was seeing a problem of cocaine use among her predominantly African American patient base. And this nurse, Shirley Brown, had probably been to a lecture that either was given by Dr. Ira Chasnoff or based on his work, and he had been creating this panic about babies prenatally exposed to cocaine.
And crack babies, you mean?
They were called crack babies, but based on a study of 23 of them, he created a panic and an industry, basically, of alarmist claims that these were children who were uniquely harmed in ways different from any other prenatal exposure. And the media picked it up almost immediately because the drug use was associated particularly with black mothers. And ever since slavery, when white people had to convince themselves that it was okay to steal, kidnap babies away from their black mothers, we have had a rhetoric, a narrative of black mothers who aren't good at loving and caring for their own children. And so this drug use was associated with black moms, and people were willing to instantly, without any scientific basis, believe that the children would be uniquely and severely damaged. Crystal Ferguson is a lovely woman who had two older children. She was pregnant. She went to the hospital to give birth. She gave birth to a perfectly healthy baby because, as it turns out, none of the criminalized drugs, including cocaine, cause unique harms or a predictable set of harms. And that's why the appellation crack baby doesn't crack baby makes no sense. There's no, it would be like saying a woman who ate an excessive amount of broccoli had a broccoli baby. So we know that the not taking criminalized drugs, taking lots of substances during pregnancy may not be a great idea, may be a bad idea, but the risks of harm are not greater than those of nicotine babies exposed prenatally to nicotine. And the harms are never, don't even compare to fetal alcohol syndrome, which occurs when there's a huge amount of alcohol use and often a genetic precondition and also probably malnutrition by the mom. But let me get back to the Crystal Ferguson story. This white nurse thought she was seeing a particular problem of drug use among the African American patient base, and she, rather than talking to the women, saying, well, why are you using cocaine? And how is it helping you? What is it doing for you? Do you think it's helping with something that something else might be better? And without waiting for the research about whether there really were unique risks of harm, she heard that women in the upstate of South Carolina were being arrested, went to the hospital lawyer and said, why can't we have these women arrested? And the hospital lawyer didn't say, we're a hospital. We provide care. We provide confidential care. And by the way, our own drug treatment program in the psychiatric division won't even accept pregnant women. And instead of saying any of those things, the hospital lawyer said, what a great idea, called a meeting with the hospital medical staff, the local police, and the prosecutor's office. And together they came up with a policy of secretly, in the guise of medical testing, secretly searching their African-American pregnant patient base for evidence of cocaine use. And if it was positive, turning that information over to the police and working with the police to have the women taken out of the hospital in chains and shackles. And Crystal Ferguson was the named plaintiff in a lawsuit that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where we won a decision 6-3 from the Supreme Court saying that secretly searching hospital patients, including pregnant women, for evidence of crimes without a warrant, without a consent to a search, not to a medical test, but to a search for criminal justice purposes, violated their Fourth Amendment constitutional rights against illegal searches and seizures. It meant that the actual doctors could be liable, that they could be sued themselves, and we were nobody thought we could ever win such a case. Most of the plaintiffs were African-American, low-income women who had used drugs while they were pregnant, and we got the Supreme Court to indirectly recognize their full humanity, their full constitutional personhood. Unfortunately, it didn't really stop the no single Supreme Court decision. I mean, Brown v. Board of Education was an extraordinary decision that there was no doubt about its importance, its statement against segregation, its statement on behalf of the humanity of African-American people in the United States of America, and the schools still haven't been desegregated or equally funded. So I guess as you started out, I think we all hope that a Supreme Court decision will bring about finality and change. And when it touches on issues like racism and sexism and fear, that change does not come about because of a decision or a new law. It comes about over the course of time as a result of cultural change and incredible persistent work at the core issues about do we recognize that everyone has human rights, regardless of their race, regardless of what they put into their bodies, regardless of how their gender or their gender identity.
You have had some more successes. I reported on some decision a few months back that came out very strongly.
We've had quite a few successes, and it's hard to keep in my head and my heart the fact that when people can access lawyers who are zealous and have the ability to really fight for them, they can win. And that's why, actually, there's a difference between reproductive rights and reproductive justice. If you can afford a lawyer or you have the resources to find a lawyer who might be able to represent you pro bono for free, you might actually be able to exercise or at least protect and defend your rights. But if you can't afford a lawyer, you don't actually have rights or access to health care. And that's one of the reasons that women of color leaders came up with the concept of reproductive justice, that it's not just a fight for reproductive health, it's not just a fight for reproductive rights, but justice that enables everyone, because they are protected in their humanity, in their civil rights and human rights, so that they can have the same health and rights. It's not just something that people of wealth and privilege can afford. And Joanne Chetta at an international harm reduction conference said it really would be wise to move from drug policy reform to drug policy justice, so that we ensure that everyone is not punished or discriminated against based on what they put into their bodies, their drug use, and it isn't something that is applied differently because of race or class or access to the defense and support that people need. We've won three cases this year in state Supreme Courts. One of them was a case in New Jersey in which pregnant women who had opioid dependency problems, a woman got herself into methadone treatment, which is exactly what the state of New Jersey recommends, the federal government recommends, and the World Health Organization recommends. But as a result of a series of judicial decisions in New Jersey that started back in the middle of the so-called crack baby crisis, that court decided that the state's civil child welfare system, the system that takes children away from people who can't parent, could be applied to the context of pregnancy. That a drug-using woman, upon giving birth, that giving birth itself was an act, giving birth to a baby who tested positive for a drug, perfectly healthy baby for whom she risked her life and underwent pregnancy experienced pregnancy and childbirth and perhaps underwent cesarean surgery to deliver, that it's child abuse to give birth to that child based on nothing more than evidence of drug use. And we've been fighting that back. We got a victory saying a positive drug test alone is not evidence of having harmed a child. But since when do we think of any newborn who even has a health problem, much less not a health problem, as a harmed child? They're sick babies. Sick babies are born all the time, and generally not from drugs. Pregnant women who use opioids or receive opioid treatment can have newborns that go through a withdrawal sequence called neonatal abstinence syndrome. The great news is that it's completely treatable, it's completely transitory, there are no long-term effects, and more importantly, if you know what you're doing, then what you do is you keep the baby and the mom together, you let the baby have skin-to-skin contact, you let the mom breastfeed. And those all reduce the likelihood of the symptoms. And the symptoms are crying and not feeding well and things like that. Well, what they typically do, because they haven't paid attention, and there's so medical students have about 3 hours of addiction training in their entire medical school career, is that they take those babies away and put them in the neonatal intensive care unit, the most expensive place. And as Dr. Ron Abrams says, you know, if you take a baby and put it in an abnormal environment, it's going to act abnormally. In any event, this mom got her, pregnant woman who was going to be a mom, wanted to be a mom, got herself into methadone treatment. Her newborn, according to the hospital, showed symptoms of neonatal abstinence syndrome. They put the baby in the NICU, kept it there so long I have real doubts about whether they were not doing medical malpractice. And the woman was accused, reported to child welfare, and accused of abusing and neglecting her child, even though she had been in medically approved methadone treatment. And we did. We won a decision from the New Jersey Supreme Court saying that methadone treatment per se is not, a pregnant woman obtaining methadone treatment is not per se child abuse. Unfortunately, they keep the door open, and so we have to go back, because the court said, well, but we really don't want to let these moms off the hook. So maybe if she didn't get into treatment quickly enough, you can treat her, who did everything she could to have a healthy baby, as somebody the state can supervise, surveil, and control. What people don't understand about the child welfare system, and this is one of the things people should watch for, is that they basically can put people on parole without ever having arrested or convicted them. In other words, they say, if you want to keep your kid, or if you don't want to be dragged into court to have to prove you can keep your kid, then you better let us come into your house this many times. You better go to parenting classes, whether or not you need the parenting classes. You have to go to drug treatment, whether or not you need drug treatment. You might have to stop getting the methadone that is working for you because the judge doesn't thinks methadone is another form of an illegal drug, or another form of dependency, which is wrong. So what we see around the country is, as legalization happens in Colorado and other places, the backlash, and there's always a backlash, is taking place against pregnant women and parents.
That was an interview I had with Lynn Paltrow. She's the founder and executive director of National Advocates for Pregnant Women. They're on the web at advocatesforpregnantwomen.org. This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm J.E.